Hello and welcome to another edition of the International Intrigue Audio Newsletter. This is where we read our two main stories out to you so that you can multitask and go about your busy days. This week we've got two stories as always. And the first one is the G7 finance ministers just agreed to a potentially huge rewriting of international tax laws. Now, I know that sounds boring, but bear with me. I think you'll agree by the end that it's both important and more interesting than it sounds. Our second story is about Japan and the Tokyo Olympics. There have been reports that a COVID wave would be imminent if the Olympics were to go ahead. The vaccination level in Japan is very low. So will they go ahead? Stick with us till the end when we give you the results of our forecasting question that we asked you 2 weeks ago. The results were quite interesting. Without further ado, on to the first story. The G7 tax agreement. Let's talk about the G7 and tax. Let's effing not, I hear you say. And normally I'd be cussing me right out alongside you. But stick with me, because last weekend, the meeting of G7 finance ministers reached an agreement that could prove to be the most consequential change in global governance this decade. The G7, some quick context. In the wake of the 1973 oil crisis, four chaps decided in a library that losing so much money simply couldn't stand. Have a guess what they called their new group. The Library Group. I know. At that point, it was just the US, UK, France, and West Germany. But by 1977, the slumber party had expanded to include Japan, Italy, and Canada. And the name changed to the Group of Seven. Honestly, the marketing. Traditionally, the finance ministers meet about a week before the G7 summit to sow and water the seeds of global bonhomie. The idea is to tackle the more technical issues in advance so the, how shall I put this kindly, less detailed-oriented leaders can rubber stamp and promote any agreement. The key facts. The G7 finance ministers met last weekend and agreed to a potentially very important tax deal. The G7 summit will take place this weekend in Cornwall, and God help our retinas if Boris Johnson goes surfing. The G20 will take place in October this year in Rome. What problem were finance ministers trying to solve? Tax havens. I knew that famous tax havens like the Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, and Jersey offered huge tax reductions for corporations. But I was shocked to discover that about 40% or $650 billion of multinational profits are shifted to tax havens. Ireland, Luxembourg, and Switzerland are the main beneficiaries, and the EU and US are the biggest losers. Wait, Ireland? What? Yep, Ireland has emerged as arguably the largest tax haven in the world. It imposes an effective rate of less than 5%, which is why more than 1,000 big US companies, including Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and Intel, have a huge presence there. In fact, US companies account for about 70% of the profits of the world's 100 most profitable multinationals. And due to a lack of international cooperation, regulating them has proved very difficult. So what was agreed? Are you still with me? Okay, I'll be quick. The first pillar. A minimum global corporate tax rate of 15%. This doesn't mean that countries must increase their corporate tax rate if it is lower, but that multinationals in that country will be subject to a 15% effective tax rate. I'll let Gabriel Zucman, an economist at UC Berkeley, explain. Take a German multinational that books income in Ireland, taxed at an effective rate of 5%. Well, Germany now can collect an extra 10% tax to arrive at a total rate of 15%. Same for profits booked by German multinationals in Bermuda, Singapore, and so on. The point. Well, there won't be an incentive now for governments to offer lower rates and for multinationals to seek tax havens. The second pillar. Apportioning the profits to where sales are made. Firms can't move physical customers from Scotland to the Cayman Islands, no matter how much a Scottish customer may welcome a tropical relocation. So they shouldn't get to move the profits either. The point? To avoid tax arbitrage by taxing the profits where profits are made. The two pillars are estimated to generate an additional 50 to 80 billion a year in tax revenues for governments. Two emerging narratives. One, this is a great thing. Mostly, people are just excited that senior politicians and officials acted like adults for the first time in a while. As Janet Yellen, the US Treasury Secretary, said, "What I've seen during my time at this G7 is deep collaboration and a desire to coordinate and address a much broader range of global problems." That is indeed important. We're a long way from declaring, "Multinationalism is back, baby," but it's a step in the right direction. And it's probably a step that wouldn't have been possible during the Trump years. The agreement also addresses a major reason why global inequality is widening so quickly. The biggest multinationals pay almost no tax. So you might expect tech giants to have resisted this move. Well, as Nick Clegg, the VP of Global Affairs at Facebook, said, "This is the first step towards certainty for businesses and strengthening public confidence in the global tax system. We want international tax reform to succeed and recognize this could mean Facebook paying more tax and in different places." He's referring to the fact that countries, for example, France, the UK and Canada, have started to introduce digital taxes, which makes complying with multiple tax regimes more costly than actually paying more tax. The second narrative, pfft, it'll never work. Call me skeptical, but Clegg in that quote above sounds very much like that of a smug mafioso who welcomes the police into his restaurant, safe in the knowledge that the body is long disposed of. Did I just call the former Deputy Prime Minister of the UK a gangster? Perhaps I'll leave it to Martin Sandbu of the Financial Times to make my point for me. The bad news is that the new rules are so full of holes as to put sieves to shame. Some other criticisms. Countries aren't committed. The intention of the first pillar is for the global minimum tax rate of 15% to replace individual digital taxes. But countries signaled an unwillingness to do this. Do they even want global rules? Small countries who rely on multinational tax revenues will never sign on. Irish Finance Minister Pascal Donohoe, and I am sure I butchered his name, ominously suggested that countries like his could band together to ensure they weren't left worse off. Ireland stands to lose about $2.7 billion in tax revenue. Zoom out. All this is far from certain. The agreement will need to be enacted by each national legislature, which could prove, well, will be difficult. You can be sure that the agreement will change considerably between now and then. That said, it's easy to see which way the wind is blowing. Countries have had enough of unchecked globalization. This is at least an attempt at a grand bargain, one that little L liberals might be wise to champion. And regardless of your political philosophy, I think businesses should advocate for this best case scenario. Insisting upon genuine transparency and fairness in global business is the best way to subject globalization to appropriate checks and balances without rolling back its immense benefits.
The Tokyo Olympics. Should the show go on? To some people, i.e. me, the Olympics are simply the greatest show on earth, filled with pageantry, mastery, and global kumbaya. To other people, I suspect most, it's simply that month every 4 years when you've got to endure your mate's overnight transformation into synchronized swimming specialists or archery aficionados. But I think we could all do with getting at least a little hyped about the postponed 2020 Tokyo Games this summer. If not for the spectacle of watching sport climbing as one of the game's six new sports, then for its symbolism as a light at the end of our collective pandemic tunnels. A COVID Armageddon in Japan. With less than 2 months until the Olympics begins, around 80% of Japanese people fear it will become a super spreader event and want their government to cancel or postpone the games. Their protests come amidst the fourth wave of COVID infections spreading across Japan, where only less than 3% of the very much aging population is fully vaccinated. The Japanese Prime Minister, Suga Yoshihide, meanwhile, insists that the Tokyo Games will be a sign of humanity's triumph over COVID and bring hope and courage to the world. Against a chorus of criticism from health experts, he promises to deliver a safe and secure Olympics. Because nothing screams fun like safe and secure, right, Mum? How did things get this bad? Anyone who's visited Japan has been wowed by its remarkable sophistication and efficiency. So much so that a Japanese rail company once publicly apologised for its train's inexcusable mistake of departing the station 25 seconds early. So, why has Japan's handling of COVID been criticised as less than sophisticated and efficient? Despite being quick off the mark to contain COVID, Japan hit many hurdles in its vaccination rollout. These include risk-averse bureaucrats, which required local clinical trials for foreign vaccines, i.e. all of the vaccines, and having technical glitches that overran the country's testing and vaccine booking platforms, a lack of manpower since only registered doctors and nurses and not other professions were permitted to vaccinate the patients, unlike in other countries, and finally, Japanese leaders failed to provide concrete plans despite their hospitals being at near capacity. So with an additional 15,000 athletes plus 90,000 of their entourages from over 200 countries expected to descend on Japan at the Games, you can see why so many Japanese fear the country simply won't cope. As a random aside, tsundoku is the Japanese art of buying books and never reading them, while blagging is the British art of faking you know what a book is about when you haven't read it. A suicide mission. Why the Games are still going ahead. There are a few reasons why the show will go on. The first is national pride. Symbolically, the Tokyo Games were meant to be Japan's prestigious comeback to the world stage after two decades of economic malaise and difficult recovery from the Fukushima nuclear accident. Two, domestic politics. Prime Minister Yoshihide needs to pull off a successful Games to maintain support within his own ruling party and to resuscitate his sagging national poll numbers. Three, economic cost. The fallacy of sunk cost, hey? The Tokyo Games have already cost the Japanese government $26 billion, more than three times more than its estimated budget. So, if they're cancelled, the Games will symbolise a gigantic government failure on that front. And four, regional grudge. Japan's long-standing joust with China plays a big part. If the Tokyo Games were cancelled right before a successful 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, then that would show that China has eclipsed Japan in world importance. And yes, grown-ass world leaders still tell their people that shit like this matters. 5. International obligations. The contract between the International Olympic Committee and Tokyo only allows the IOC to cancel the Games. So, if Japan was to unilaterally cancel the contract, then much of the risk will be borne by the Japanese Organising Committee. And, remarkably, a global pandemic does not qualify as a reason for cancellation, according to the contract. Technically, Japan still has the end of June to pull out of these Games, but considering the cost listed above, I think it's unlikely they will cancel, despite high risk to Japanese citizens. So, we should expect a wave of bad COVID-19 news this summer.
A little bit extra this week. So you might remember, if you're a longer term listener, that 2 weeks ago we asked you a question and wanted you to help us forecast. We asked, will there be a major cyber attack on critical infrastructure in a G7 country before December 31, 2021? Well, we received 92 responses, and here's what you thought. And we've included a graphic in the newsletter, but the rub of that is that 57.56% confidence of yes was the consensus forecast. So there's about an even money that there will be a cyber attack on critical infrastructure in a G7 country before the end of this year. We had 92 people respond, and the most common response was the 71 to 80% chance. You provided lots of great reasons for your forecasts, but here are two that sum up each end of the scale. 3%. A cyber attack on critical infrastructure of a G7 country is a likely precursor to a more significant move, and I just don't see that happening in the near term, say out to 2023. Fair enough. 80%. And I quote, capitulation to ransom demands doth not a kidnapping deterrence make, me just now. That last comment is a very on-brand one for international intrigue. So if whoever that was, if you're listening, hit us up if you ever want to write a piece for us. But the most important comment came from a reader called Michelle, an experienced forecaster, and I apologize if I've mispronounced his name. He is Polish. I find it hard to make a forecast because there should be a more precise resolution criteria. The resolution criteria should specify what it is critical infrastructure and what would count as positive resolution. I think you meant for a successful cyber attack, but this is still not precise. He is, of course, spot on. In fact, we bet most of you probably spotted those problems without question. There's an old adage in data science, garbage in, garbage out. Or, put more charitably, if you don't ask the right question, people can't give the right answer. While we were trying to demonstrate how the forecasting technique might be relevant for businesses and policymakers, we ended up demonstrating something different. If you want to use quantitative analysis to make decisions, the source of the data must be of high quality. Or maybe that was our mission all along. Spoiler alert, it wasn't. We're actually hopefully going to work with Michelle and other experts to learn more about high quality forecasting. So if you would like to get involved, just drop us a note. Okay, that's it for another week. Oh, thanks for listening again, guys. We really appreciate it. We get a few hundred downloads of our audio edition each week, so it tells us that at least some of you are finding it convenient and useful to consume our work on the go. Nothing more to say this week other than you can get in contact with us the same usual ways, which is on Twitter at INTIntrigue. You can reply directly to the newsletter, and we would love it if you went onto your Apple Podcasts app and reviewed our podcast, ideally with 5 stars and a nice review. That's all from us, so until next week.